while for you to dig it up. It was, it's from the essay by A. Waite from the Hermetic and Rosicrucian Mystery by from the Occult Review. Now there's a copy of that in the book section. It's an essay. It's got some missing things. And towards the he does a schema, and this is what he says here about this is the Hermetic and Rosicrucian Mystery from 1908. The alchemist is himself finally the stone, because many zealous aspirants to the art have not understood this. They have failed the great work on the spiritual side. The schedule which now follows may elucidate the hard subject somewhat more fully and plainly. Then he gives a list, and and what it is it's a list of A through K of might say levels of this of aspects of this of the great work, and they're not this is not a direct correspondence to these cards, but you will see that there is a connection. There are the natural external man, whose equivalent is one vessel. And that's where we're going to begin tonight with Das in just a minute. So we're going to refer to this list. B, the body of desire which answers to gross matter. C, the aspiration, the consciousness, the will of the supernatural life. D, the process of the will working on the body of desire within the outward vessel. E, the psychic and transcendental conversion thus effected. F, and this is a long one, the reaction of the purified body of desire on the essential will, so that one supports the other, while the latter is borne upward. From such raising, there follows this further change, that the spirit of a man puts itself a new quality of life, becoming an instrument which is at once feeding and is itself fed. G, herein is the symbol of the stone and the great elixir. H, the spirit is nourished from above by the analogies of the Eucharist ministry. I, the spirit nourishes the soul as by bread and wine. J, the soul affects the higher conversion of the body of desire. And K, it thus comes about that the essence which discovers everything and changes everything is still contained in a vessel, or ultimately that God abides in man. This process, thus exhaustively delineated in the parables of alchemy, is put with almost naked simplicity by the Eucharist doctrine, which says that material lips receive the supersubstantial bread and wine that the soul is nourished by, that Christ enters the soul. It seems, therefore, within all reason and all truth, to testify that the panis vetius et valetus, the living bread and
vine, has arrived,
is even as the transmuting stone and that of the chalice of the New and Eternal Testament is as the renewing elixir. But I say this under a certain reasonable reserves because in accordance with my former indication, the closer, the analogies between distinct systems of symbolism, the more urgent is that prudence which counsels us not to confuse them by an interchangeable use. And then, to wrap this up, by the way, this is on page 5 of that essay that I'm reading to you. All Christian mysticism came forth out of the Mass book, and it returns therein. But the Mass book, in the first instance, came out of the heart of the mystic, which has unfolded in Christendom. The nucleus of truth in the missals of the Lord is nigh. The Mass shows that the great work is, in the first sense, a work of the hands of man, because it is he, officiating as a priest in his own temple, who offers the sacrifice which he has purified. That is relatively clear for weight. An introduction to kind of what he is trying to get to with these images. I haven't found anything that's been published. Doesn't mean that it hasn't been published, it just means that the time that I've had to research this stuff, I haven't found anything that offers any clear correspondences with these cards and with some of what Waite wrote. So an introduction, I want to introduce a couple of simple ideas that are going to be underlying everything that we talk about for the entire 5 weeks. And we don't have to, they're basic, fundamental, basic ideas. The first one is the three levels of mystical initiation. This is almost universal in Christianity, and actually in almost all forms of mysticism, which is, and the three levels are usually called the purgativa, or the purgation or purification. Then there's the illuminative way, which is what we're going to be mostly concerned with looking at these images, and then there is the unitive way. So there are three levels of Christian initiation. The first one, which we're going to just allude to a little bit, but it's usually extremely important. It's usually what most tarot readers are referring to when they do tarot readings. It's basically people going through initiations that have to do with purifying the natural human being as opposed to the spiritual human being. The second degree, which is the one we're going to spend most of our time discussing, is called the illuminative way, which means the way of light. And what it represents is basically when a person awakens to the spiritual life. It's when the spiritual life becomes something that is alive for them. That's somehow they know that the world, in its natural sense, is actually nothing more than an invitation to this deeper world. This is where things like immortality, love as the primary goal in one's life, these are where these things start becoming alive. This is the way of the soul. The illuminative way, it's the way of the soul. And then there's the third way, which we'll allude to a little bit, but will not discuss of mysticism, and it's called the Unitive Way. And this is actually, you'd say, is the way of the spirit. The Unitive Way is where the divine, in some absolute sense, completely takes over, and where there's a real difference, you know, a palpable difference between the soul, which is our sort of living psyche that's aware of the divine, and the spirit, which is basically the domain of the divine. So those three levels are important initially to have in mind, and to know that we're not going to be talking too much about one that is very basic, which is the purgative way, the way of purification. A lot of people don't spend much time, but actually, if you've got a situation with your connection, just hit *6. We'll mute you so we don't get any kind of feedback. And now there's one other idea that I want to entertain briefly, which is part of this way that this is approached through meditation or prayer. Prayer is a big term for all the types of things one does to orient yourself to your own inner life. In a purgation sense, it's how you're sorry for your your sins thing. In the illuminative way, it's sort of like how you become aware of the divine and angelic presences in your life, and in the unitive way, it's God is the sum and substance of everything that you are, even to the point of your being no self. That the only thing that actually exists is the divine. But aspect, there's two things I want to emphasize around the nature of prayer, and one of them is called cataphasis. That's a big fancy term that doesn't get used a lot, but I mean, it's C-A-T-A-P-H-A-S-I-S. You can look it up. And it means affirming by affirmation. This is the visionary way of mysticism. And this is classically, very strongly part of, it's also the symbolic way. It's also very strongly the illuminative way. And basically, it's where symbols have symbolic meaning. But cataphasis doesn't really work without its opposite. And the opposite is very popular now in pop mysticism. And the term classically used for it is a term that comes out of rhetoric. It's called apophasis. And apophasis means basically beyond vision and experience, or to affirm by denial. And basically what it is that you know that everything that you say, that you can see that the whole world is divine and shows divine presence, but you can also say that at a certain level, if you look at the world a certain way, the world doesn't show you the divine. It shows, and so the only way that you can affirm that the world is a symbol for the divine is by denying that the world is the divine. And it goes ultimately to you deny all images that you make in your mind, all words and meanings that can be made in the world, that at one very deep level, they do not capture the subtlety, the pervasiveness, the beauty, the grandeur, the truth, the simplicity, the presence of the divine. So, apophasis.
So those words, apophasis and...
It's A-P-O-P-H-A-S-I-S. You'll probably see it more written as apophatic, which is adjectival form.
And how about the other one?
And the other one is cataphasis, C-A-T-A-P-H-A-S-I-S. So,
okay, thank you.
The difference is A-P-O and C-A-T-A. Okay, that's it. That's my my total lecture that as far as needing a serious orientation for these images. And is anybody else, anybody got any questions or comments they want to make about this stuff, this is the time to do it. Okay, I haven't heard anyone say anything.
I'm a little confused about that cataphasis, because when I look that up, it's a speech disorder in which a person constantly repeats a word or a phrase.
No, I look at
that. Okay. That's not the way it's being meant here, David. It's a term that's out of, it's a common term used in religious discussions of these things. And it's a technical term. It just means affirming by affirmation, where the other ones means affirm by
David? It's not unusual for medical terminology and even educational terminology to borrow from the language of theologies and mysticism, etc. Not unusual at all. Okay.
Okay, so, alright, so the next thing that I want to move on to, which is just as again orientation, but this is another class. I mean, this would be a couple of classes in itself, and we're just going to say you should all, not that you should know this, but this is stuff you can learn. One is that for weight, as far as this collection of 22 cards go, which is the major arcana. For weight, this set presupposes, you might say, and this is open to interpretation, but this is how I'm using it, the Rider-Waite-Smith deck. And the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, which is based on the Golden Dawn, and based on, and there are correlations between the Golden Dawn's major arcana and the Tree of Life, you know, following the Golden Dawn. There's variance on these some of these things as far as the interpretation goes and the images go. We don't need to look at too much of that, but what we can say, and this is just an as-if, this is a controversial point, but it's how we're going to get started with looking at these images here. We're going to say that those images and that way that the Tree of Life is portrayed represents the Tree of Life as it relates to the natural man. If I go back to the list that I came, it says there are the natural external man whose equivalent is the one vessel, the body of desire, which answers to gross matter. The aspiration, the consciousness, and the will of the supernatural life. Well, this external man, this is the Tree of Life as the equivalent of Crown and Malkut. That Malkut, which is the lowest world, and Crown, which is the highest world, are two sides of one coin. And so everything in the Tree of Life is you could say sandwiched in between. You know, it's sort of like there's the crown, which is, you know, the heads, and there's Malkut, which is tail, and everything else is inside the coin. which is, you know, the edge, which we don't usually look at. And that is one way of understanding the natural man approach to the tree of life, and how how that inner world works. However, and here's where we begin, and we actually get started by looking at these images. We start with, in this version, we do not start with the crown and Malkut. We start with the unidentified, right? The missing, the occult, the mystical Das, which is the so-called 11th Sephiroth. That's where we begin with this tree. And the paths for this tree change completely. So we're beginning here, not in the natural world, but in the world of Das, which is both the natural world and the supernatural world, but in a way that neither exists. And what is this way, the via illuminative, the symbolic way, what is it? Well, it's very much like language. The words I use are symbolic. In themselves, they mean nothing. The only way that we understand one another is that we all, quote, speak English. So to the degree you understand me, it's just because if you were all Chinese listening to me, I'd be making a bunch of noise and it would mean nothing. So that's the conventionality of language meaning something. So we are all, as it were, when we speak to one another, participating in this non-existent word, which brings things together and yet shows that nothing has any serious substance or any real reality to it, which is Das. And Das is this no man's land of symbolism, which is where we're beginning. And at a very deep level, let's open to abiding in the sanctuary, to the first image, which is the Das image. And there are three images that go with Das. This is plate zero, page 88. Das, given his knowledge. I assume that most of us can read the text that's provided for each image by Marcus and Tali. But every now and then, if somebody wants to, they're perfectly will. Please, if there's an issue that you want to raise with it, feel free to cite it to raise it to read it aloud for the record if we want to discuss this stuff. So we're looking at Das. We're looking at the image, and it's there's two church symbols and a mystical, illuminative series of aura concentric circles. We have to think of that. That's this endless circles are one of the main circles of light, or one of the symbols that seem to be almost universal in all the images here to some degree. So this balls of light. And here we have, and in it we have the chalice and the priest holding up the Eucharist before his heart. And he's looking at this. This, by the way, is a non-Trinic picture. This is a Pippet picture, I think is you guys know. Yeah, Pippet. If we flip over, we could look at the two other images for Das. see that he's rogue. That's important as a recurring symbol. Here we have raised in the right hand of the celebrant, which would be to our left, the host. And on the left hand of the celebrant, there's the raised chalice. Raised on, and this is raised above the head again with the robe, and then the colored image of the doff. The robe is different, mainly the collar is different, and primarily, but also the shape of the hat, bishop's hat. And here there's a the raising of the host. And the chalice is only kind of towards, not above the head, but at the eye level.
And these two images, Paul, were rejected.
And the other thing is that in the second picture, there's the person standing on a globe platform with clouds. And in the colored picture, there is three, perhaps, steps. That may represent, the three levels and what those three levels are. These are questions that we're actually going to have to explore. I don't necessarily have answers for all of this stuff. But those are the elements that we need to pay attention to. They are the primary way that one is being initiated into this level of the illuminative life. They are through the sacrament of the bread and wine, the body and blood of Christ. This is where natural man becomes a supernatural man, or the supernatural life. This is where this is how it is fed. This is how it is transformed. It is through the partaking of the transformation of the Eucharist. Now, the other thing for Wade is he was a Roman Catholic, and he was never not a Roman Catholic. And so this idea of the sacrament, which we want to explore right now, is extremely important. It is the underlying mystical sacramental way that all of these images partake. In other words, in some ways what we're going to be going through is an inward transformation of how the body in Christ, the body and blood of Christ, transforms a human being to become aware of levels of their own spiritual nature, their own soulful nature. All right. Anybody have any questions or comments they want to make about the chalice and the Eucharist? Terms of their own perspectives on this. You don't have to believe in this stuff to appreciate the symbolism of it.
Paul, I notice in the accepted version that which is a black and white version compared to the Pippet version, right? Or is this the Pippet version? No, the Pippet version is the accepted version. And the other two were rejected. That are in the book. I noticed the chalice is rather large.
Yeah.
Much larger than the figure itself. The figure looks like a bishop or a pope, and across the band of his headpiece is the word Unitas.
Right.
And in the background is two churches, one on his left shoulder, if we were he, or to our right, looks like a pseudo-Vatican type of dome. And on the opposite shoulder, there is almost like some sort of celestial cathedral that I cannot...
Looks more Gothic, you might say.
Yeah, Gothic. It doesn't look like anything that I know of. Maybe when other people can recognize it and give it a name.
I think it looks like Shatra.
Shatra? Well, yeah. Oh.
Many images of Shatra, which is like the Gothic cathedral.
Oh,
and with a lot of mystical.
We might also want to understand that arises from the three supernal Zephyrs. This is the text from Tales and Marcus. Kether, Chukma, and Vina. The way, the truth, and the life. Another point that they make here is the priesthood here is that of the self-priesthood of Melchizedek, or the holy place depicted in this order of the everlasting day. And then contemplative themes are probably are interesting. they have as terms, and in this case, these are terms that are essential for understanding this level of singularity, purpose, purity, radiance, being, expression, thought, truth, knowledge, and the mystery of inauguration. You know, Das refers to the state of Yachud, or unification. It contains and is contained by all the Sephira in the upper and lower order, and is the rose key to passing between one world and another in the four worlds. And that's actually what we're doing now. We've gone from the natural world, and we're going the Tree of Life stage, but we're entering the other world, another world. We're entering the world of symbols. Entering the world of transformation in which singularity and purpose, purity, great light, extremely important, are all aspects that are going to be open to us in terms of our spiritual understanding, again, sacramentally, to the transformation that one feels or participates in when one eats the bread and drinks and tastes the wine, which is not bread and not wine, but is actually the body of the divine and the blood of the divine, as that has become, that it is human. You know, this is the central mystery, this is the central sacrament of the Christian church. I would say that there's two other sacraments that are important before it, or at least one in this one particular case, which would be baptism, which is something that happens before one partakes of the Eucharist. You supposedly are sin-free when you take part of the Eucharist. And baptism is the way you're made into a Christian. You're purified. So that's already taken place. The baptism has taken place. Now we're entering into this taking of the mysteries. Does anyone else have anything they want to say about this? This death thing is, you know, this is essentially the fool card for this series. I mean, there is a fool card, but in another way, this card is functioning as the fool card. That every time, so that when we talk about the emperor and the empress, which we're just about to do in a moment, we're going to be constantly referring back to over and over again this idea of the Eucharist life. If you are a Christian and have participated in these rituals, or even if you're a pagan and if you participate in a similar ritual that pagans do, you can, that this is an important way of imaginatively realizing how one can be transformed in this provisional way. And this is the big thing about it. The problem with the via illuminative is it doesn't have the profound, unshakable certainty of the via unitive, the third way, which is the unitive way. When you're in the unitive way, questions of whether there's a divine or not are not an issue. It's just an issue. It's a foregone reality. But the knowing that is knowing is the thing. The problem with the via illuminative way is that it can be easily distorted. It can be distorted towards being misrepresentative, and it also can represent this way that's preparing one for the majesty of the unitive way. The thing about the unitive way essentially is there's nothing you can do. There's nothing that any human being actually does to open to the divine union. Divine union is a gift that happens, and there's no way you can make it happen. And it's very frustrating for people, you know, who might be mystics or feel that they're things, and they work and they pray and they do all these things. No matter what they do, they can have some progress along the illuminative way, but they can easily slip up and mess up. But once the unitive way opens up, and it can be opened up before you're born. In other words, some people are born with the natural state of being in the vile human. There's nothing you can do. It just either comes or it doesn't come, because your own efforts don't make it happen. You can make yourself sensitive to what's happening, because it doesn't necessarily come along in a thunder strike and knock you. It doesn't necessarily knock you off your horses as it does with the proverbial paw. But that's one of the differences for these levels. But we are talking about the central mystical way. All right.
So looking at this hat that he's wearing, this mitre. I guess that's what you call the mitre hat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On the word of unitas, which probably would mean cutter in the reality of things, there's 11 knobs on that hat. There's the top one, which would represent Doth itself, and the other 10 of those in the knobs would represent the other 10 sephira on the Tree of Life.
Well, that was actually one of the questions I had, David. I'm really glad you
brought that. Well, I visualize it. He's changing these paths all the way around, so it's going to get a little confusing.
Yeah, it's true. So one of the things is, it's good to know the other system, but we're going to be looking at it completely in a very different way here.
You have to drop your old system and look at it.
Yeah. So the next one we move to is...
May I just say, I have a question. When you were describing unification, you mentioned how the Eucharist was the rose key of the illuminative path. And there is the rose window in Shastra. Now, I don't know for a fact that this is a rendition, an imaginative rendition based on...
I was just basically reading what was written by Goodwin on the Jap thing, you know. So I know we might want to stay with this for a while. We can't. We've got a lot of images to cover. I'm going to basically present to you more questions rather than answers. And one of the things we're going to try to do at the end of this class, and from the at the end of all the other classes in between until our last one, is I'm going to ask you to each person to select some of these questions to follow up on. In other words, to look up, to do an internet search on. If this sacramental thing about the Eucharist is something that doesn't seem to make any sense to you because it's not part of your experience, then go research it, right? If DOS doesn't make any sense to you, go look it up and read about it.
Mm-hmm.
To the degree we're not necessarily going to be able to come back and discuss these things because we have to deal with these cards that we're dealing with. That's why I'm suggesting that if you do this research, you don't have to write everything down, but you know, if you could just scan it into your computer, make it into a document and send the document to me, I will then provide all these research issues that people generate. If you send it to me, I'll put it in a folder and everybody and distribute them. So we're actually going to have, if people actually do the research and make a record of the research, and send the research, I'm not going to critique the research anybody does unless, we're going to share, that's going to all, we're going to share it all at the end. So if you do generate any kind of research on your own, if you send it, I will distribute it to everyone. And just send it to my email. We have to go on. Got a lot of images to do every week. It's basically run, because with a few exceptions, and this is, happens to be one of them, with the Emperor and the Empress, we have a lot of images to cover, and we've got a lot of questions to raise about every image. And again, if any of this stuff excites your interest, then follow through on it.
Okay.
All right, so next one, we got to move on to the Emperor. Page 92. Notice that immediately we go from 0 to 11. And here is the Emperor. And seeing, if you go back to page... significance between close. And here again we have the aureoles of light, the halos of light around the emperor. And the emperor's holding up his right hand and his with the symbol of benediction. The symbol of benediction is basically the hand held flat out, palm up, with the small finger and the ring finger down, and the three fingers held up. The three fingers held up is classically the benediction. This is also the sign that is used by priests when they're doing the sign of the cross. His other hand is on his knee. He's got long hair. Again, what's the meaning of long hair? This is a symbol. It means something. It means something in these cards. What does it mean? Why is the emperor and the empress, again, you can see this sort of aureole radiation of the sun around their head, and they're sitting on a dais. They're sitting on a pedestal. What is the meaning of the pedestal? So it says here, according to the emperor is the masculine face of God descending into Jogba, the quarry of devotion. And here are the things: singularity, purpose, purity, radiance, being, expression, thought, and truth. Notice that a number of those were same themes were in Daf, but there's a couple of new ones, particularly truth being one of them. Now there's another version of the emperor, which is across from the empress. Here the layers of the radiation are more strong, and the face also is more vividly depicted. Both of them are color, and then the empress. And so there's this male-female polarity that's being brought up. So we have the first polarity being brought up. We have Daf, and then we have this polarity. The polarity of the emperor and the empress, mama and papa, mother and father. And in fact, the contemplative themes here are the mother, the divine feminine, the soul of nature. Beth means house, temple, daughter, tribe, tent, dwelling place. And think of all of those things that are relevant to the divine feminine, the way we think. And also think of the emperor, that Alf is the ox, one clan, cattle. And remember that cattle for nomadic people would be their nature form of wealth. It means to learn, to train, to tame, and to teach. And it means community and family. So, with the Empress, we have her sitting, again, surrounded by these halos of light, sitting on a dais, and her hands are enfolded in her lap, a classic sort of meditative hand folding that you would see. And apparently it's right on top of the left. The right hand is on top of the left, which, by the way, is the opposite of Buddhism, which usually puts the left on top of the right. And again, she's got long hair. And again, she's robed. What does that mean? And then there's the color version of the Empress, which is also the one that's on the cover of this thing, in which we have this aqua blue color. I don't know, maybe somebody's got a better name for that color. And again, there's this pedestal that she's sitting on. The way the color one is pretty close. So, let me
the colored one, she appears to me to be becoming naked. And also somewhat be
less clothed.
Yes. And it would seem that she's almost levitating off the pedestal. And that it may be a moot point, but it's left on right, her hands. It's her left over her right.
Mm-hmm.
It is?
Yeah. Anybody else?
On the color one?
All three.
Oh, okay. All right. That's, yeah, you're right. Okay, that I just did that in my head. You're right. Okay. Thank you. I'm not really good with left and right.
I'm good when I'm not doing it.
So I'll make that mistake a lot of times during this thing.
May I say something, Paul? This is Colleen.
Yeah.
This just kind of reminds me, the way she's holding her hands, she could be kind of holding her stomach like she were pregnant. If we're talking the difference between theology and mysticism, and if she represents, say, Virgin Mary, she's embracing the light that came to Earth. So it just kind of struck me as that way.
That's actually one of the questions I have, in my view. Well, the Empress is classically the mother in the sense of Demeter. She's not necessarily the Virgin, though. She's, she could be, but she isn't necessarily. That she is paired with the Emperor. We've got the Emperor and the Empress. One of the questions I have, and this is also going to come up with the High Priestess card, which is also classically a goddess card, is to the degree that Mary, or Marian imagery, which in the classic Marian imagery is mother and child, is not portrayed strongly in this set of cards. In other words, there isn't a strong emphasis on Marian imagery, which is Mary, to be heretical for a second, the fourth, the completion of the Trinity. You know, you have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and then you have Mary, who represents the Shekinah, the world. Jung talks about that.
In the Orthodox Church, in the middle, there's the sanctuary where the holies of holies and the sacrament is blessed and distributed. But on the right hand side of the iconostasis is the Pantocrator Christ, and on the left hand side is the Theotokos. So they fall in the same kind of arrangement on the Tree of Life. I just thought that was kind of interesting.
And I'm really glad you brought that up. That's a good point, and it was definitely one I have overlooked. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Part of what it is now is. So I have a question.
Was that Debbie who just spoke? Paul?
What?
Was that Debbie who just spoke about the pregnancy?
It was Colleen.
Colleen, I think you're right on with that pregnancy look, especially on the colored picture. I mean, that looks like her belly is enlarged there very, very clearly. And it's being held up by her hands.
Well, again, that goes with the classic Empress. I mean, and the
this is the mother.
She is.
Not the Virgin Mother. Virgin Mary could be the mother, just the divine feminine.
That's not the. I don't think that's in dispute. It's just really.
I'm just agreeing with what you said. I think that she's kind of very clearly.
All right. Let's. Does anybody have any idea about the long hair? the nature of the here that we have here. Or, again, the meaning of the vestments versus the clothing. So we have two more sets of cards that we're due to do today, and they're the wheel and the chariot.
God,
under whose wings all living things dwell. And then, quoting from a neophyte ritual in the Golden Dawn, I come the power of light, I come in the light of wisdom. I come in the mercy of light, the light hath healing in its wings. The contemplative themes for the wheel are divinity, movement, creation, connection, unity, wholeness, and healing. Camel, maturity, to do, perform. And again, camel would represent, would be, you know, locomotion would be the ability. The camel wanders in the desert, self-sustaining. Individuals are bound. The 13th path is united by the uniting intelligence and is so-called because it is itself the essence of glory. All right, so let's look at these. Let's look at the 13th path of the wheel. And what do we have? Well, we have the zodiac sign of the wheel in its abstract form. And the torso of this angel, whose wings are up and who is robed. There are two versions of it here, and no colored version. Anybody have anything they want to say specifically about how the wings in their not fully spread out way create a kind of halo around the head of this angelic thing, which has been related to the Shekinah. And then if you flip ahead and look at number 14, and you'll see the chariot. See how the wings are different. See how this character is nude. So you have the masculine, feminine again. And chariot is open. Open. Daf is opening this gate portal. Contemplative things, ascent, revelation, cleaving to God. Opening of the soul. And again, the chariot, everyone, you can get out your, what's the name of that biblical book? Not Eden, but the Ezekiel. Get out your Ezekiel and read how the wheels are seen in the sky, which is the chariot vision of the Merkaba. And here we have these, the wings here, they're spread out, flying. So we have resting wings of the wheel versus the extended flying wings on the dais of the nude chariot. And again, one of the things that is a question that I'm leaving open for us to share as an insight that comes to us, what do you think the symbolic significance is of here the resting wings of the wheel and the open wings of the chariot, the wheel and the clothed aspect of the Shekinah versus the nude and open aspect, and look at the other postures here with the chariot. And there are 14 guys. Arms are outstretched and high. He's again standing on a dais. The dais has wings. He has wings that are open. That come that seem to extend out of his shoulders or his neck and out of his backbone. So this and the Dalf as the nature of the letter represents opening gate or portal. Versus maturity to perform. of the wheel, or Camel Gimel versus Dauf. Quoting from Reward of Contemplating a Chariot, after the greatest of his rewards is that he brings him into the celestial chambers and places him before the divine throat, becomes knowledgeable of future events of the, in the world, who is will be thrust down and who will be raised up and who will be weakened and who will be strengthened and who will be impoverished and who will be made affluent and whom will decree death and who will be life and from whom will be taken away an inheritance and to whom will be given an inheritance. Again, I'm reading the text out of so
I have a question, Paul.
Yep.
On the chariot, what does the term spiritual self-nullification mean?
That's in, where is that?
In the first paragraph.
All right, let's see here.
This can be realized by, in the last sentence, this can be realized by the practice of the tool, which I don't know if it's Hebrew or...
Spiritual self-nullification is a... that's actually something that somebody could actually research. Bitul, may not be the best transcription. You might want to look at the tool. Might start with a P, not a B. But the Pitul, and that's something you can look up. It's a form of meditation that has to do with not affirming your ego, your egoity, or your own.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's right, Paul. It's like losing your ego, becoming self-nullified.
But it was also done as a form of, there's different levels of it. Some of it, you know, is being sorry for your sins is a form of spiritual self-nullification. Sincerely sorry for your sins. And no longer wanting to hurt people because of your own selfishness.
I didn't get that out of that sentence. I just thought that during a sensitive meditative state, we go into a state where we lose our consciousness of our ego and become one with the higher source, the spirit.
Yeah.
No longer we connect to our ego needs or ego desires or wants.
But at another level, David, what you just said is being sorry for your sins. In other words, at the level of illumination, but the level of the natural human being, part of spiritual nullification is being sorry for your sins. At a deeper level, it has what you said, and at an even deeper level than that, it has an ultimate sense of in which, you know, you have the classic stories of the mystics in which they literally have no sense of self anymore. You know,
well, that's what I'm talking about. I agree with that.
Yeah, but the difference there is that there's a discrete difference between the three levels. They're not all the same. So part of the way you were, depending upon how we wanted to listen to it, part of the way that you were describing Vittal as this self-nullification makes sense from the point of divine initiative or the unitive way, in which your nullification happens through grace, through the action of the divine, which is not yourself, in other words, it's not self-initiated. Whereas in the level of illuminative way, spiritual nullification, self-nullification, is an act that you can practice to a degree. And what it's do, well, one of the things it does is it can prepare you to be aware of the grace that will, quote, replace you or take you over from the point of view of unity. So you're classically in the lunar way, you're between two worlds. You're between the fallen world, which is the natural world, and the perfect world, and the illuminative way is you're in both and in neither. So that it's a perilous place to be, and it's perilous because you can easily be deceived here. It's really almost classically wonderful in terms of understanding the moon. You know, the moon is a wonderful, powerful card that represents deep insight and even hails the beginning of true enlightenment of the sun. And yet, at the same time, it's a seriously difficult card because we can be so easily deluded. You could say in a lot of ways that the way that I'm interpreting this set of cards is we're interpreting them in terms of them being this illuminative way is that they're all moon cards. They all represent both a way that they represent the truth and the light and the reality of the unitive presence of spirit and the divine totally, and at the same time that we can also seriously become deluded and even demonically deluded to where we think that we are I personally am the divine power and goodness and truth and beauty and all that stuff. But I just wanted you to know that just in case you thought I was deluded or not.
I didn't think you were deluded. But I'm looking at the picture of this place 14. I mean, it looks like he's standing on the esotic state, which is the ego state, which is very large in that picture. And he raises his arms.
That's how you're reading the dais as the ego?
That's right.
Okay.
And then he looks up and he's got his arms raised. He says, "Thy will be done." He's getting beyond his ego state. He's beyond the self at that particular case. He's nude. He's totally open. He's accepting what's coming. That's the self-nullification.
Okay, this is actually really good. This is a great reading. I really appreciate that. And, okay, so given that wonderful way, how does that compare or contrast with our wheel, where she's one clothed and her wings are not fully extended, and her feet are, together, and she's holding the wheel. How would you interpret that kind of those images? And again, we can compare and contrast. We have, as it were, here another couple. We're going to see that Wade in this imagery is really into his polarities between the masculine and the feminine, very powerfully so. And again, in a mystical way, this makes perfect sense because, particularly in the via illuminative, the normal sexual energy or the bliss of sexual congress is naturally is the crux and of the incredible transforming bliss of the divine union. I mean, they're not different. One's transmuted. One we use to serve our pleasure, our pleasure principles and our id, and one we use surrender in a way to a power beyond ourselves and beyond our ability even to carry. I mean, one of the things in the unitive way is that we know that the splendor and power of the divine is so powerful that any form can't stand beside it, but must ultimately surrender to it. And that's why you need this self-emptying. If you don't have a self-emptying, you become annihilated in a...
Paul?
Yeah?
This is Cynthia. I have a sense of... the nude figure of the chariot as being the wheel itself bursting through the Vischia pessus, is it? Above the wheels or the Shekinah's head. And I do note that her hair appears to be fairer than certainly the Empress's hair or the chariot. The chariot, the new figure of the chariot. And my sense is that the wheel has been birthed.
I agree that could be very, very much that what we could have here is, in that way, the wheel, in terms of the way she's holding it, is this is the birth of the Empress, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Empress is pregnant. In a way that we had to argue about, right? Whether she was fully pregnant or not, but she was creating a wheel, holding a wheel lower, in a gestating sense, and now, and of course here, this wheel is instead of coming down, which is natural birth, this is a rising up, which is supernatural birth of the wheel. So this is, you're right, there is this birth symbolism taking place here. Again, one of the symbols that comes over and over in these cards that we need to explore is this idea of ascent. In other words, there is this kind of motion between things. And I think that we're getting some good insights here, so keep them coming, folks. You're teaching me a lot of good stuff here. Taken a good strong look. So in some ways, the quietness, again, what do you think that dais might mean? Not the dais that's in the chariot, but why aren't the emperor and the empress sitting up on those pedestals? What does those pedestals mean? Going back to this below and above and rising up aspect. So we can sort of see that the illuminative way is a natural moving upward. That maybe moving upward represents, the spiritual ascent, which, in terms of classic symbolism works.
Am I muted here, or can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I think of those towers. I look at those towers on the Emperor and the Empress cards, and they immediately reminded me of the Asiatic world. I mean, the thing is just the world of the physicality, and both the Emperor and the Empress are in charge of those, that particular world.
Now, you're talking about the Das card, the first card that we looked at that have the towers.
No, I'm talking about the Emperor and the Empress. They're sitting on those towers.
You're calling them towers and I'm calling them pedestals. Okay.
I think they represent the Asiatic world, the world of physicality and the body. And there's the emperor and the empress are in charge of those worlds, basically.
Right, and this is them being at the apex of them, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, I think representing that.
And again, going back to the wheel, the aureo, the halos around the emperor and the empress, right? What do those represent? They represent the potential of the wheel.
Well, very likely. I think that's true. Because I think the wheel card it represents going from Keter to Dot. It's going from the wisdom of the universe to hold the universal energy down to knowledge. It's self-knowledge, and that wheel is about self-knowledge of the world. Isn't that the wheel of the Buddhists?
Yeah, it is, and it's also classically a zodiacal wheel. But the zodiacal wheel and the wheel of rebirth symbolically is the same thing. In a piece that we may quote next week from Plotinus, we're going to be talking about the placement of the images in Egyptian temples. It's a famous thing in Plotinus, just about a page long. And in some ways, These cards, we can deal with them individually, but we really also need to place them around ourselves. You know, to see, for instance, that the presiding priest of Das and the mystery of the Eucharist is the sacrament that is opening all of these up to us. So what does it open up to us? It opens up to us the Heriogamos, the great marriage between the emperor and the empress, right?
When Paul mentioned that perhaps the emperor and the empress are sitting on towers. Am I correct? He mentioned towers?
Yeah, that's David. Yeah, mentioned.
David, I'm so sorry. Well, that really may not be too far-fetched, because in this series, I hate to almost call it a tarot, in this series of meditations, visual meditations, or visual Lectio Divina, the tower is the Tower of Babel, and here clearly the emperor and the empress that belongs to the tower, that sits on top of the tower, not man.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my thought.
All right. The point specifically of the teleconference, as I said, is not necessarily do all the research, but is to actually share our insights. And what I wanted to do with the last 30 minutes we have of this call, to a degree, is to get us oriented, for those who are going to return, get us oriented to the kind of research that you can do during the week. You don't have to commit to anything if you don't want to. You don't have to do this. If you do decide to do it, make a record of the research you do. If you find a good website, copy down the URL. You don't have to copy it, or key passages in the URL and send them to me with your name so that you get credit for doing this work. From other people, they'll know who did it. And we will go on. So one of the things I want to go over very quickly is some of the issues that are going to come up next week for the images that we're going to discuss next week. And we're going to continuously go back to what the chariot is, what the meaning of the wings are, again, the issue of clothing, the meaning of light, the meaning of ascent, the spatial dimensions, the interaction, the male-female interaction of the cards. So we're going to start next week with strength. And you see now, if we look at strength, jumping ahead, which is number 15, questions you, one of the books, I wasn't able to find I don't think I was able to find an online version of Lamps of Western Mysticism. If I do, I'll post it on our books, which is a book that Waite wrote on Christian mysticism. We have, again, something that's very close to the wheel, except now she's nude. Again, there's a closure of the wings at the top, and there's a more intense halo. So there's a profound transformation of the wheel and strength in this series, particularly again the nudity and the halo. So seeing the differences. And also, again, going back to the symbolic meaning of this. Now we go to the magician. And in the magician, we have, again, as above, so below, in terms of the gestures. Clothes. the star above the head, five-pointed star, a cross and a rose, I believe, a rose cross. In the center of his chest, the elements being two chalices and two flowers. One looks like a wheat stalk, and the other one looks like a carnation. Maybe it's a rose, which probably represent the elements. The three-pointed cross. In my things I'll send you is I did a download from Christian symbols that give some of the history and differences between the different styles of crosses. And this three-point crosses where you have one vertical and three horizontal crosses is a common one. But again, what does the symbolism of that kind of cross move? And then from the magician, we have the fool. And again, we go from clothed to nude. We have the nailed feet of Christ on a little globe. We have a huge dark globe above, in which the fool seems to be perhaps crucified to. So we have the fool possibly as a Christ image. And then we have one of the more compelling images, and also in this, which is the high priestess, with the possibility of the fool being below, rising in a pillar of light. And again, we have the circular degrees of light. We have the high priestess, again, sitting with her hands in her lap. And it's possible that she is holding a scroll. I thought for a while it looked like a bird, but it shows you how bad my vision is. And again, she has the sort of horns of Isis for a thing. So those are some of the future images that we're going to deal with, and we're going to attempt to understand a narrative. I think that one of the things that will happen as we proceed with this discussion that we take place here for the rest of the month is, one, we'll get a really good idea of what these images are about, and we may not have a definitive understanding of what the cards mean, but we will have a really pretty clear understanding of how the images are telling, and the symbolism is telling us a story, and what that story is going to mean. And it'll come out of all of our efforts. So, looking over this material for the future, I recommend that taking a theme such as what does unity mean? What does the five-pointed star mean? What's the difference between being clothed and nude? Those are big things. Seeing the fool, and the letter for the fool here is Zayin, which means sword, spear, or weapon. So how does the Zayin, and here it says Zayin is the spear which pierces the breast of Christ, and here clearly is shown the stigmata, the figure of the fool is Christ. Also, there's a huge literature on the Harlequin Christ, which is just another way of saying fool, the Christ is the fool. And foolish wisdom. So there's lots of things that you can select, and uh, as I said, bring them to the table if you wish. Send them to me ahead of time, and I'll distribute them before the class, definitely after the class, as things go. Does anybody have any issues they want to bring up now?
Can you hear me, Paul?
Yep.
I was questioning the double chalice on the magician's table, so to speak, and the Pope or Duff.
Yeah.
The two churches behind, and only because Waite did discuss the hidden church, and yet he was a Roman Catholic. But it's hard for me to square all of this away in my head. Not that I have to, or that Waite owes his historical record any explanation, but to me, I think he's implying that strongly.
Well, yeah, I think that people who've read the Meditations on the Tarot by Anonymous,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of really good hints in those letters. Definitely. There are good, if I was going to suggest the places, definitely that would be a place to look up the sacramentalism
mm-hmm.
as it relates, if that's an issue that you want to explore. A good place to look for that is in the Meditations of the Tarot by, actually the guy who wrote it is Valentin Tomberg. He was a anthroposophist for a while and a convert to Roman Catholicism the last 20 years of his life. And he wrote Meditations of the Tarot as a self-conscious Christian hermeticism. There's definitely, though I don't believe that Tomberg ever met Waite. There's no record of it. They could have met each other, but that doesn't appear to, and it doesn't appear that Tomberg ever references Waite's initiatory works at all. His orientation seems to be much more strongly oriented towards the French occult societies.
Just to mention, Paul, I forget what on page of Meditations Tomberg goes into this, but just in this benediction and the sign of the cross, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in the name of the Mother, Daughter, Holy Soul. So, I mean, excuse me, we can consider that as well.
There's a lot of things, and as I said, the material that I'm providing through the website is really
Development
is, yeah?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I've always a telephone.
All right. Actually, there is one more that we're dealing with next week, which is the Last Judgment, which is, we have Strength, Magician, the Fool, the High Priestess, and the Last Judgment. So again, Strength, you can see is a continuation of the triads that we've been dealing with. and then we have the Magician, Fool, and the High Priestess, and then the Last Judgment seems to represent another level of understanding. And again, why is the Last Judgment, you know, at this place? You know, consider the order. Look at the separates in between and what they mean. If you already know what some of this stuff means, then...
Mary Greer has arrived.
How you doing, Mary?
Hi. Fine.
You just arrived, right?
Yeah.
I was going to pick your head 15 different ways. But, What we're doing right now is we're going over what we're going to be dealing with next week, which is...
has left the conference.
Which is the week two, we're going to discuss the Strength card, the Magician card, the Fool card, the High Priestess, and the Last Judgment. And this class has been recorded, so a recording of this class will be available.
Okay.
That you can listen to. And what I'm basically trying to get people to do is to look ahead and to do research on themes that are repeating in the cards. For instance, we have the difference between nudity and being clothed is a big thing. The position of the wings in the angel cards that we were looking at tonight. Mm-hmm. The sacramental position of the which is the whole point of this. The way I'm looking at this collection of cards. And next week, I'm going to be reading a chapter out of Plotinus where he deals with the images in the temple, because in some ways, in Egypt, and in some ways, these cards are actually sort of need to be sort of put into a temple in our mind. We're starting to get a picture of what that temple is, that it begins not doesn't begin with... the crown and Makut, as the crown and Makut being like two sides of one coin, and everything in the tree being inside. Or here we begin with Daf, which in this case is presented as the great marriage, and the great marriage is between the emperor and the empress. And the Empress is potentially, they're both at the pinnacle of sitting atop of the world, as someone said. Some of the stuff was just discovered in our conversation tonight. There is the next two cards being the wheel and the chariot. We have the wheel is a celestial birth. It's a birth, whereas the Empress is alluding to pregnancy. The next one, where we go with the angel and the closed wings of the angel, and we have the wheel is rising up. So we have sort of a spiritual birth being represented by the wheel, and then the wheel. Opens up, and again, from being clothed to nude, we have the chariot, and this way the feet are on a dais, which is fully extended and floating in the air. We have this opening of the mind point of that. So with the chariot, then it would continue with strength, which is what we'll be dealing with next week, which continues the angelic presence. And here we go back to something that looks very much like the wheel, except she's nude, and her resting wings are closed in a way. And then we have another triad. Basically, everything's in a sort of triad dyadic formulation with emphasis on male-female symbolism. We'll discuss the magician, the fool, the high priestess, and the last judgment. So that is a summary of what happened in this class tonight.
Great summary.
Anybody got any questions and/or anything that they want? Any questions they want us to consider?
Has
arrived. has left the conference.
What was that?
Well, if people have it on a speakerphone, we're going to get feedback. Well, a lot of people are on are muted. But anybody who wants to share anything, any questions, any insights, it might be a question that you have or something you want to explore may help.
I'm not clear on which images are we supposed to be using. We have sometimes two or three images of the same card, black and white, sepia, and colored. So which ones are we supposed to be...
We use all three.
Look
at all three of them. Look at their differences and their similarities. Try to figure out if the differences and similarities have any meaning or what they might mean. This is one of the reasons why, you know, I emphasize the gestures, how they're different with the DOS card. And what would that mean about the idea of the sacrament of the Eucharist, which is, you know, this whole set of cards representing the via illuminative way of mysticism, which is between the unitive and the purgative way of mysticism, represents, as I said, classically what the moon is. So, in some way,
I think that's a critical question, because when we look at the Tree of Life presented in Goodwin and Katz's text, some of the images are the black and white, some of the colors, some of the sepia. So, it must have a meaning.
For instance, the Empress. The Empress is very muted. The original has not, I mean, not the colorized version is so watercolory, hazy.
And that's the one on the tree.
That's the one on the tree and on the book cover.
I am not going by Tali and Marcus's use of what image they selected for the tree is having any definitive meaning at all.
Okay.
I'm looking at all the images, and so I want you to pay attention to the differences of the images and the difference of how the color is done and the difference of how the flowers are done.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much, just to give you a sense of what they may mean and what some of these variants may mean. I don't think that we have to choose, let's say one is definitive and the others aren't. I think that if we have three to choose from, look at them all, see what the differences are, see what they might be saying about the meaning of what the card means in terms of its of how it's using the symbolic space.
Okay. Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you want to choose, it's okay, but not for this thing, we're going to look at all the images and try to get a sense of what they mean to a degree. And so also, if anybody does do any research, again, I encourage you, if you're doing it online, to jot down the websites you find useful, to make copies of any text that you find that seems relevant to the questions you're exploring. Send them to me, and I will make them available to everybody. There's a lot more here than we could possibly discuss in the time that we have.
Well, on Mount Tabor, it was Moses and Ezekiel who witnessed the transfiguration.
I don't know. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about the transfiguration in the gospel.
Okay, you're talking in Matthew or something?
Yeah. I know that Moses was present. Three of the...
Enoch
was present.
I don't remember. I don't
all
remember.
Right.
You have something I have to look up?
Because I'm trying to follow through thematically with the Eucharistic...
In other words, look at the transfiguration...
Right, and the Merkaba mysticism.
Okay, it was Moses and Elijah.
Elijah, thank you. It was Elijah. Okay.
Definitely. That's something you can... that's definitely a thing to explore with us. There are libraries.
Libraries and libraries.
Libraries available at
libraries.
So enjoy yourself. Find some good. I may not have links to the up yet to the stuff that I made from some internet sources on the meaning of vestments and the meaning of the crosses and other basic Christian symbols. But I will, if they're not up there now, I'll get them up within the next week.
Hi, everyone. This is Janine.
Yeah.
Here in Canada. And I don't know the etiquette. I have to leave a little early, so I wanted to say thank you. And I got a lot out of it tonight, and I'll certainly be back next week.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye, Janine.
Well,
we're
supposed to pick a card that we wound up with.
Janine Hall
has left the conference.
I'm not putting anybody on the spot to do anything in particular, which means that maybe nobody will do anything at all. But to the degree that you've got questions about stuff or want to follow up and stuff, go ahead and do it. One of the places that it makes sense to follow up is following from Tali and Marcus's notes on each card from Abiding in the Sanctuary, looking at some of those things and doing a little more exploration. Also, exploring more explicitly what the cards mean in the path that they're on when they're between something, which is in that section on page 82 or something. Was it? 80, page 82 and 83, where we have the plate number and the paths and the Hebrew letters.
Mm-hmm.
Those can all be explored if one wants to and if you do, just make the material available to me so that I can make it available to everybody. And even though we may not discuss it, it will make the experience of our discussing these things more widely.
I wanted to mention something. Miss Mary.
Yeah.
I photocopied some of the plates, the ones that are labeled as plate, and put them on my iPad and have been using one of the art programs to color them myself. And it really helps you to look very, very deeply at all the details. Plus, it's lots of fun, and on the iPad, it's like finger painting.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so you downloaded the ones from the...
Actually, I had some ones that I had earlier, copies of the plates. But the ones for the plates are basically the best. You can lighten the lines or, sharpen them, or you can play around with them so that they're not quite as strong, and then use your color to fill in, because some of them are so dark that it's hard to get color on them. But if you play around with it, you can do a lot of stuff with the images.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
You could do it on your computer, too, using your phone or something.
Application on the iPad?
On the iPad, I've been using one called Art Studio. Yeah, one word, Art Studio.
I want to go back to the opening quote in the last couple of minutes that we got of this thing. The opening quote was from page 5 of that essay written by Waite called The Hermetic and Rosicrucian Mystery. And again, the alchemist himself finally is the stone, because many zealous aspirants to the art have not understood this. They have failed the great work on the spiritual side. And then he has a listing of the way this stone image unfolds, and from A to K. The natural external man, whose equivalent is the one vessel. The body of desire, which answers to gross matter. And again, I was saying that it kind of represents the natural man, which I see as the regular tarot. And I'm seeing this particular tarot, Major Arcana, is representing the middle path of the mystical path, which is the illuminative way, which in his case is the aspiration, the consciousness, the will of the supernatural life. The process of the will working on the body of desire within the outward vessel. So the outward vessel here would be not the illuminated way, but be the way of purgation, the way of that precedes this opening to the spiritual life that represents the illuminative way. When he gets to F, it's the reaction of the purified body of desire on the essential will, so that one supports the other. This is where he's starting to talk about the transformation from the purgation way towards the illuminative way. The latter is born upward. Again, remember upward symbolism, such as raising, there follows a further change. And here in the symbol of the stone of the great elixir, and the spirit is nourished from above by the analogies of the Eucharist ministry. And again, we said the whole meaning of this entire set, starting with Doth, is the mystery of the Eucharist, which is the bread and wine. The spirit of the soul, the spirit nourishes the soul by the bread and the wine. So the reason I read all this stuff at the beginning was those are the themes that he mentions in this essay from 1908, which, though not in any form, shows sort of fundamentally the sacramental basis by which he understands the meaning of these cards. So the cards primarily mean the illuminative way, which is basically the moon. It's both guides you towards the spirit, but you can also, because you're still influenced to a degree by your unregenerate natural self, you can also sort of fall away from the way of union. The problem with union is that union comes as a gift, and you can't create it by effort. You can make yourself open to it by effort, but you can't. Union comes from the divine directly, and cannot be compelled. So, and again, that's on page 5 of that essay, which is. Which I have which is available on my website. So that's it for tonight, folks. And we'll continue. And I'm going to. I really appreciate everybody who helped, because you helped me understand these cards a lot better than we would have otherwise. Than I would have otherwise, just from. The research I did. So I appreciate everybody showing up, and we'll be here for another 2 hours next week, and we're going to get through all the cards and uncover a lot more of what they mean and what they're about. I appreciate you for showing up.
Okay, good night. I'm going to stop the recording now.
Okay.